Morning, honorable members, everybody present. As some of you may be aware, the chairperson is unfortunately not in today, is off sick. For that reason, we are going to need to elect a stand-in or an acting chairperson for this morning. So can I call for any nominations for the acting chairperson? Thank you. The Honourable Abrams has been nominated. Are there any other nominations? Okay, in the absence of any other nominations, is there a seconder for this?
Thank you, sir. I, Doris Madileta, second the nomination of Abrams as a teacher.
Thank you. Honourable Abrams, you may take the seat as acting chairperson.
Mandates flows from the Financial Sector Regulations Act. The shareholding, we have dealt with this in the oversight meeting, and I will not spend time on that. Just to restate that the board helps just ensuring governance, but has got no role on policy and regulatory decisions. What is not known is the other functions that the Reserve Bank does. We issue bank notes and coins. We regulate and supervise certain entities of the financial system, and we ensure the effective functioning of the national payment system. We manage the official gold and foreign exchange reserves of the country. We administer the remaining exchange control regulations, and we act as a banker to the government. The main rule that flows from the Constitution, of course, then, is to ensure price stability or low inflation, which is a traditional policy, a traditional function of central banks. All central banks have this mandate in some form, but they may use different frameworks. We are using the inflation targeting framework. The other alternative is the fixed exchange rate systems, which have predominantly been found in Asia. And third is the targeting of monetary aggregates, which is what the SAP used to do in the 80s and 90s. And many of the SAP's functions have got a socio-economic impact. But then why do we target inflation? Start from the ground zero. So inflation is a general increase in prices. It's measured by Statistics South Africa using a basket of goods and services purchased by a typical household. At the moment, the CPI basket includes 412 individual items that contribute towards the index. Well, low and stable inflation becomes important because it protects the purchasing power of South Africans. It reduces uncertainty, helping firms and households plan for the future. And so while monetary policy improves the environment for investment, it cannot determine its level or its quality. Thus, protecting the value of the currency permits balanced and sustainable growth, but does not guarantee it. It is a necessary but not a sufficient condition for it. I've included a slide here just to demonstrate how inflation hurts. I've used the price of bread. We did this last year. We asked the staff of the bank to go into one of the local supermarkets and said on that day the price of bread, it was 12.95, that if that price was to rise at the midpoint of the inflation target range of 4.5%, that loaf of bread will cost us 31 rand by 2038. And if we were to allow inflation to rise to the upper end of the inflation target range of 6%, that price, that bread will cost us 42 rands by 2038. And if we use the average inflation of between 1993 and 2002, that loaf of bread would cost us 60 rands. And if we were to go back to the bad 80s, which we had in South Africa, where inflation averaged 15%, that loaf of bread will cost us 212 rand by 2038. We used the price of bread here. You could have used any other commodity. It could have been any other good or service. It would yield the same results. The Financial Sector Regulations Act gave us the mandate, explicit mandate for financial stability, and we had to put together a framework, and our financial stability framework helps us to monitor and mitigate against risks to financial stability. We conduct stress tests to South African banks and insurers. In other words, we test if there are macroeconomic shocks, how would the macroeconomic shocks affect the South African banks and insurance. We also evaluate how regulatory reforms impact on the financial systems, and we have now developed a toolkit of macroprudential instruments to mitigate potential systemic risks and restore financial stability if needed. And lastly, it provides a legal framework for resolving systemically important financial institutions. So you might have all the preventative measures and you could still have a systemically important financial institution getting into trouble, and you need the tools to resolve that. And this framework provides us with that. So let me move to the core, which is the macroeconomic overview and outlook, and say that global growth rates have been moderating in 2019 and into 2020. And the presence of trade tensions do not help the global growth. So global growth rates have been revised lower in 2019 to 3.4%. And what we have there is a breakdown of which countries contribute to growth. By far, the biggest contributors are emerging markets, and the advanced economies are contributing just around 1.1%. And going forward over the next 3 years, we see that the contribution of the advanced economies declines. And what that means is that the global economy is slowing down, which means that global demand is lower, and that means that the demand for exports from the export-oriented countries are going to be adversely affected. So global economic growth has rebounded a bit in the first quarter of 2019, driven by advanced economies, that is the Eurozone, the US, and Japan. And in part, as earlier, one of events that had dampened economic activity faded, and that a loss of momentum appears to have occurred again from the second quarter onwards. And with the trade tensions not abating, we see the risks to the global economic outlook being on the downside. At the same time, what we have seen is that global financial conditions remain accommodative. By that, we mean that for emerging markets, there continues to be capital flowing to the emerging market countries that are able to access capital markets. And because the advanced economy macro settings remain accommodative and actually relaxing in some of the cases, mm-hmm. What we have seen is that emerging market countries are able to access funding at fairly affordable rates. What that chart shows at the top, it shows how much is easy, and at the bottom it means that conditions are getting tighter. I'd talked about the impact of the trade tensions on global growth. So after a sharp drop at the end of 2018, which was exacerbated by once-off developments in China as well as disruptions to river traffic in Europe, world trade volume growth posted a timid rebound in the early months of 2019. However, this rebound has proved to be not sustained. And what the graph there shows is the extent to which world trade volumes have declined. And with the declining trade, the global economy cannot sustain the momentum that we had seen in the previous year. However, countries that have got stronger macro fundamentals have experienced lower borrowing costs. On the far end of this panel is Argentina, which has got pretty precarious macro settings, and you could see that the premium that lenders demand from the Argentinians to insure against default is just over 8%, closer to 9%. That is what we call the credit default swaps over a 5-year period. And Argentina is followed by Turkey, and then immediately after Turkey is us. To the right are the countries that had embarked on periods of macroeconomic consolidation over the past 3 years and sustained it, and you can see the benefits. Their borrowing costs are significantly lower than ours. Of course, if you have got good macro settings, it reduces the edge for currency weakness. So if you look at this panel, you will then realize that the Argentinian peso had depreciated significantly, followed by the Turkish lira, followed by the Russian ruble, and then the South African rand is the fifth, roughly in the middle of that emerging market universe in terms of how much we have depreciated. So as it would sometimes be said, well, the good news is that we are not alone. So it just looks like we are less bad than the others. But based on this panel, we have performed better than a number of countries, and we are roughly in the middle of that panel. Domestic economic outcomes flowing from the developments from the international side remain weak. Economic activity is weak, with insufficient investment and job creation. Potential growth, which is an outcome of investment, remains very low, and here investment is used broadly to include both physical investment and human investment. Inflation remains within the target, and risks are relatively balanced, with some key exceptions being food prices and rent risk related to credit ratings. And the fiscal environment has deteriorated, leading to rising bond yields and undermining business and consumer confidence. It's not all gloom. In the second quarter, we had a rebound in real GDP, but it has been modest growth thus for the year. South Africa's real GDP advanced at an annual rate of 3.1% in the second quarter of 2019, after the slightly revised contraction of 3.1% in the first quarter. The recovery reflected a turnaround in real output of the primary, secondary, and tertiary sectors. But growth has also been volatile and been largely driven by sectors that either recover or contract. And as you can see on the graph here, we have been very volatile. You couldn't see a sustained recovery or a sustained growth over a number of quarters. So we rebounded in the second quarter, but we contracted in the first quarter. The same picture went for last year, where we slipped into recession in the first half of the year, and then we rebounded in the second half of the year. So we actually need to be laying the basis that we actually sustain that growth. Put simply, what you would like is to see that red line rise and sustained over a period of time if we are going to make any impact on the jobs situation. When we look at growth across comparatively, we have seen weak growth, which has limited flows. And in that universe, you could see that our growth compared to the other countries is pretty benign. These are emerging market countries that are part of the G20, and we have then also included the advanced economies. So whereas in 2018 we sort of like were in line with Brazil and Japan and to some extent the UK, in this year it has been very clear that we are lagging behind. One of the important beneficiaries, the drivers of the growth, has also been household consumption expenditure, which has changed positive, but even then it has been less so for durable. The blue bar, part of the bar there, reflects non-durable expenditure on non-durable goods, and the red one is expenditure on durable goods. And you can see that although household consumption has recovered, expenditure on durable goods has actually still remained negative in that quarter that we are talking about. Confidence has been low, which has hit investment and thus reducing growth. On the left is the Bureau for Economic Research Business Confidence Index and investment, and you can see that investment has tended to track what happens with business confidence. Business confidence is the red line, and the blue line is the investment performance. So very clearly, we will have to get confidence back in order to get investment to go. And as it is normally said, that restoring business confidence is the cheapest form of stimulus because you spend nothing on it. On the right part of that panel is investment broken by sector. The red line is investment by state-owned enterprises. As you could see in the period around 2006-07, it was very strong and it was an important driver of investment, but it has since declined significantly, and it actually growth in investment by SOEs had remained negative from 2016 about at a state negative for that period. General government, which is the rest of government exclusive of the state-owned enterprises, had also turned negative and had stayed as such throughout that period. The only thing that saves the investment situation has actually been the private sector, which is the blue line. And as we had said, with business confidence, unless business confidence is restored and sustained, that too might also suffer. So total investment remained weak, mostly negative since 2015, and it has been related to continued low and below neutral level of business confidence, neutral here being 50 index points. Of course, with weak investment and weak growth, unemployment had gone up, but unemployment has also gone up mostly as a result of labor participation rates. There are a lot more people entering the labor market, and in the manner in which these things are measured then means that absent lot of new jobs being created, the number of labor market entrants is more than the number of jobs created, and as a result, unemployment creeps up. I talked earlier on about countries with good macro settings benefiting from with lower borrowing costs. And what this slide just shows is that it shows South Africa being the red line, and Brazil being the blue line, and the emerging market average being the black line. And you can see that both Brazil and South Africa, in the earlier part of this year, we were moving roughly together. And since about June, we started to diverge. We stayed roughly constant, whereas Brazil has been able to bring down those long-term borrowing costs. The reason is a very straightforward one. They have managed to bring down their inflation faster than us, and their inflation targets have been revised lower. And as such, they are able to reap the benefits in the form of a reduced inflation premium, which then contributes to lower borrowing costs for the Brazilian government. The macro settings that we have in South Africa and the rise of debt in the South African market, predominantly government debt, has contributed adversely to the current account deficit. What this graph shows you, it shows you different components of the current account deficit. If you could just concentrate on the red portion of the bar. The red portion of the bar is interest payments that we are making to foreigners. So it goes without saying that for us to then reduce the current account deficit, we have got to be reducing the pace at which we are accumulating debt. Because the more debt we accumulate, the more we are going to pay in interest, and with the foreigners participating in our market too, that means we will be paying that as part of the current account deficit. But we have also experienced fairly strong terms of trade. Strong terms of trade means that we are supposed to benefit from exports, but we have not been, we have not quite benefited. Exports remain constrained, and part of it has to do with the state of the global economy and the fact that trade tensions are actually contributing to a decline in trade volume. So, put simply, we cannot be saved by what is happening with the global economy because the global economy is actually slowing down. Turning back to the domestic, headline inflation has remained around the midpoint, and underlying inflationary pressures still remained muted in the first half of this year, partly reflecting continued subdued consumer demand. Services prices are trending downward towards the target midpoint and core towards the midpoint of the target range. And core inflation, core goods inflation has shifted higher, but it is still below the 4.5%. So the inflation outlook is contained. What has been bothering us over the years has been that in spite of the inflation outcome, the expectations of what future inflation would look like had been had remained sticky towards the upper end of the inflation target range. But from around 2017, gradually inflation expectations had been moderating, although they are still above the 4.5%, which is the midpoint of the inflation target range, the trend is a downward one. But inflation is still high in some of the categories, and food prices could still pose a risk while they are still comfortable. On the panel there, on the highest bar there, shows the pace of price increases of the insurance sector. It is followed by education, alcoholic beverages and tobacco. There isn't much you can do. People who consume these things do not seem to react to prices. And what's been worrying has been housing utilities, because the housing utilities are the things that actually set in part by the government. The other categories are showing a declining trend, and later on I will show what else happens. So, when we look at what we had called administered prices, the picture becomes clearer as to who is actually driving the inflation. Water rose year-to-date by 12%, electricity 7.7%, rates and taxes, which are set by local government, rose by 9.5%. Education, 6.7%, and others have remained contained. So very clearly, administered prices have become an important player in what is actually happening to the inflation environment. And these are prices of goods that are consumed by households. So as even as inflation declines, because the households see these prices rising at those spaces, they then have a view that says that, well, inflation is going to continue rising, which makes it difficult for us to contain inflation expectations. So inflation is at 4% now, but administered prices year to date have risen by 7.1%. What is the growth outlook looking like? The figures that we are presenting are the projections as July, at the time of the Monetary Policy Committee. I've talked about past inflation. Future inflation shows that going forward, inflation for this year, that it would average 4.4%, it would average 5.1% next year, 2020, and by 2021 it would revert to 4.6, closer to the midpoint of the inflation target range. Underlying inflation, that is headline inflation after taking out electricity and food and fuel, also remains contained and will average 4.4% this year, 4.7% next year, and 4.5% next year. Economic growth, we are still having a forecast this year of 0.6, climbing to 1.8% next year and 2% in 2021. And as I had said earlier on, the global environment is uncertain, and that the risks to that growth forecast are actually on the downside, depending on what happens with the global economy. So improving the growth outlook, global growth unlikely to become more supportive. The US-China trade tensions and Brexit have had a negative impact on global growth. There are geopolitical tensions, issues affecting commodity prices, mainly oil. And there are we've got to be getting our domestic environment right. And that would entail ensuring that we have got a sustainable fiscal framework and commit to macro stability. Secondly, that we reduce supply-side constraints such as load shedding and labor disruption. And lastly, improving policy certainty across the domains as a basis for driving business confidence. So that is the economic picture. Let me now turn to the highlights from the SAP and the PA annual report. Annual reports provide readers with a holistic account of the SAP strategy, performance against that strategy, and the impact on society. It contains financial and non-financial information that is material to the SAP's ability to sustainably implement its mandate. The mandate is expressed operationally in a strategic plan, and that strategic plan has got five strategic focus areas. Together with the supporting strategic objectives and some cross-cutting activities that support the strategic drive, and the organizational capability and capacity objectives that drive the strategy. The five strategic focus areas you would recall from last year, the first one is maintaining headline inflation within the target range. The second one is protecting and enhancing the financial stability to achieve a safer financial system. And the third is to promote and enhance the safety, soundness, and integrity of regulated financial institutions. And fourthly, to enhance the functioning of South Africa's financial market in support of economic resilience. And lastly, ensuring cost-effective availability and integrity of notes and coins. So how have we performed relative to these focus areas? And with respect to strategic focus area one, which was the price stability, I have just presented that, and we are within the target. Strategic focus area two, which has to do with financial stability, is not as straightforward to measure as the first one, but we have had no systemic risk event occurring in the financial system during the period under review. And the governor and the minister of finance agreed a macroprudential policy framework, including the toolkit and policies to be applied by the SARB to prevent and identify systemic risks and respond to a systemic event when it occurs. The third strategic focus area that has to do with the institutions that we regulate as the SARB. The Prudential Authority was successfully launched on the 1st of April last year, and the relevant institutions were gradually integrated into the Prudential Authority. The program to establish and embed the Prudential Authority is largely on track. There were no failures of systemically important institutions, although some smaller institutions were placed under specific regulatory action. Strategic focus area four, which has to do with enhancing the functioning of the financial markets and has to do with resilience. We have broadened the scope of the of this focus area beyond just reserve accumulation. That yes, you could have a reserve, but resilience is more than just a reserve, and we have broadened that to include strengthening economic resilience. And this entailed us having to embark on significant research, and so we have the cross-cutting research agenda, which will take the work of this focus area forward. Reserves have been accumulated, but the accumulation was below what we thought we would accumulate by December 2018, partly due to a delay in finalizing the reserve accumulation strategy. The accumulation strategy necessarily entails how we are going to be funding that accumulation, and it has proved to be a bit of a challenge. Strategic focus area five has to do with ensuring cost-effective availability and integrity of notes and coins. The currency producing subsidiaries have delivered all notes and coins orders effectively, both for the SARB and the international export market. The quality of bank notes for circulations were, however, below the desired level. When notes are soiled, they have to be returned to the SARB for destruction. And what we had found had been that participants tended to hold those notes longer than they're supposed to be holding them. They're supposed to return them for destruction. And that had affected, to some extent, the quality of the notes in circulation. We needed to have those back. But nothing to worry about at the moment. We have put mechanisms in place, not just to incentivize the bank financial industry to bring the notes back, but we have also started to run a pilot where we show them what it would cost them if we were to start imposing penalties if they do not return the notes, the soiled notes on time. Financial highlights. We are not a profit-driven institution. We are a public policy institution, but we, in executing our mandate, we have got to be financially sustainable. With the profit for the period under review is 5.8 billion rand, which was 3.6 billion rand higher than the previous year, which was 2.2 billion rand. I must just caution that the profits went up here as a result of the fact that bond yields in the advanced economies were declining, and that enhanced the return on the reserves. It was a big driver. And with those returns, we also had the fact that the rent had depreciated during that period, and that bolstered the profits. The South African Mint reported a net profit after tax of 700 million, or 0.7 billion, which is a 300 million rand increase compared to the 400 million last year. And this was driven by stronger sales of Krugerrand. The South African Bank Note Company significant has also reported significantly higher profit after tax of 200 million compared to a loss after tax of 13 million last year, and this has come as a result of increased production volume. And lastly, African Bank impacted positively, contributing half a billion rand to group profit. And the table underneath just gives that breakdown. CPD is the Corporation for Public Deposits, and the other subsidiaries that then that I had mentioned, and the total group profit then of 5.8 billion rands this year compared to 2.2 billion rands last year. Of course, we have to pay the dividends to for 2 million shares that are held, a dividend of 200,000, which translates to 0.0043% of SAPS profit, or 0.0034% of the total group profit, and this was paid to the shareholders as required by the South African Reserve Bank Act. We also have some activities on corporate social investment and support. On the education front, we have awarded 78 bursaries at various levels of study from first to final year to young people with a total spend of 13 million rand. We support academic research with the following programs with a total spend of 9.3 million, and you would see that these are the areas of interest to the central bank. We fund the chair of economic journalism, a chair of financial stability, a chair of financial journalism, and a chair of monetary policy. We run a monetary policy committee schools challenge, which is a national competition for grade 12 economics learners on how the SAP sets the repo rate in all nine provinces. We do this in partnership with the Department of Basic Education, and last year 396 schools participated with a total spend of 5 million rand. We also embark on employee volunteerism. We offer infrastructural support to special needs schools in all provinces. Our social investment budget is small, and so we decided to just narrow it and target schools which cater for learners with special needs. And on Mandela Day, we encourage staff to participate in the commemoration of the day, and they give away up a day's work. They go out on a Saturday and do community work the whole day, and as part of the Mandela Day. And we support that with a spend of 3 million. Preferential procurement, broad-based black economic empowerment performance progressed well from 13.4 points for the financial year 2015-16 to 19 points in financial year 2018-2019. This is mainly attributable to increased focus on sourcing awards to black-owned and black women-owned businesses. Our target was to have 80% spent on entities that are compliant with the BEE Act, and we actually are standing at 96%. So we have outperformed the targets that we had set for ourselves. But then we realized that there is a lot of work that we had to do, which had to do with what we have called inclusive procurement. And the bank continues to target some of its procurement spend on qualifying small enterprises suppliers. This is an ongoing program that we are now rolling out. Human resource highlights. The bank has conducted two employee engagement surveys to gain insight on how it can improve employee experience. There has been a positive year-on-year improvement in the employment engagement survey. The bank's total staff composition is 74% black and 26% white. Executive management, the GEC, that is the exco here, is 100% black. Top management is 55% black and 45% white. Senior management is 64% black and 34% white. The bank spent 54.9 million rand on training and development. This equates to training 2,118 employees, or 99.6% of our complement, in attending a training intervention for the period, for the financial year under review. The coverage ratio of critical roles improved to 91% from 80% the previous year. This ratio is a ratio that we have developed that has identified crucial positions in the bank, and we say if somebody was to drop dead or get knocked by a bus or leave the bank, do we have internal capacity to fill those positions internally? And in 91% of those positions, we do have internal capacity to fill those positions internally. Another measure that we focus on is what we call regrettable turnover, which is at 1.32%. Regrettable turnover entails people that we have identified as future talent of the bank that ended up leaving the bank. We had 1.32% of them leaving for the year under review. In the previous year, it was 1.17, not material change. The staff composition, I had talked about the top management, and I would like to spend a little bit of time on that. The bars on the left reflect a breakdown overall of male and female, and you could see that through the recruitment process, the number composition of females is rising, while that of males had actually come down, and we are reviewing this over a five-year period. And the middle panel includes is for males, and it breaks down that according to race. And you could actually see once again that for the males, it has come down a little bit for the African male, but that has come as a result of females actually going up, as you would see on the far right of the panel, that the number of African females being employed had actually gone up. So has been the colored, and so had been the Indians, while that of white females had actually come down. The staff composition at senior management reflect similar trends. The difference here, though, is that you see that the recruitment of white male, of African males has gone up, while that of white females white males have been declining. This is in part coming as a result of natural attrition. Over the next 4 years, we have got about 70 people who are retiring at a senior management level and at top management level, and that gives us the space to get our ratios right. Given the history of the bank, as you would have seen, that you have got at the top management level a big proportion of white males, they are going out of the system through natural attrition over the next 4 years. Chair, this is where I said I would take your guidance. I am now going into the Prudential Authority. Whether I pause here and we take the questions, or I finish off the Prudential Authority presentation and then we take all the questions together.
Governor, honourable members, there's a presentation, the first presentation, and in terms of our agenda, I should pause here for interaction. Can we get any guidance? Honourable Lewis, Honourable George, okay. Honourable Skosana and Honourable Shivambo. Dean Lewis.
Thank you, Governor. A couple of questions. One, to ask your opinion on something.
Okay. What before that, honourable members, before that, the governor wants to know whether to continue or we deal with this first part first? So I take it that we are dealing with the first part?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Good then.
You are forecasting, Governor, an increase in growth, and I'd like to know what you think is going to drive that increase in growth over the medium term. Then, if I may just ask, you say that there's a reserve accumulation strategy. Since you don't intervene in currency markets, what is the need for reserve accumulation? Is there a balance of payments problem that you're experiencing that requires the reserve accumulation? Also, I wonder, you mentioned the last time that we saw you that an audit was done on the bullion reserves. I wonder if you would be prepared to table that, the results of that audit or the audit report, obviously with the locations and addresses redacted, that's fine. It's the results of the audit that I'm interested in. Then, just a comment on your presentation on the profits that the bank is making, and perhaps this is best dealt with by Mr. Naidu. I'll leave that to you. And perhaps you know already what I'm going to ask Mr. Naidu about African Bank. You've made a 500 million rand profit this year from the collections on the bad book of African Bank. I've asked for a very long time whether the audit of that book has been conducted to sift out reckless credit agreements that were extended to customers in contravention of the National Credit Act, whether the Reserve Bank or its credit management company, its debt collection company, have applied for the write-off of those loans, and what quantum of loans have in fact been written off as reckless credit. I'm afraid, despite my persistence, sir, and despite the contact details of a colleague that you gave to me, I still have not had answers, so I repeat that question here to you today, and I hope to hear that answer. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks very much for the presentation. I really only have one question, given our previous interactions with the bank. Now, we all know, and you've said so, Governor, as well, that our economy is very weak, there's many reasons for it. Internationally, the economy is also looking rather weak. But you are obviously an independent institution, but you're a very important part of our economy. What I want to know is whether you do have engagements with the government about the economy. So, for example, you mentioned sentiment. Obviously, it matters and it really costs nothing. But obviously, investors are really turned off by South Africa, I think, at the moment. So what I'd like to know is, if you have conversations with government as an independent institution and stakeholder in our economy, and then what are you telling government about the sentiment, about their own behavior, about government spending, etc., and the impact it is having on our economy? Also, perhaps, what you're saying to government about government policy that might be interfering with economic growth. So I would be very interested to know that. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Member, Honourable Member.
No. Thanks, Honourable Acting Chair. I think we welcome the presentation by the Governor. I think it does assist us. Governor, I think you have indicated the wide range of challenges that are facing us economically, highlighting the challenge that our economy has not been growing, particularly since 2015 date. And I further indicated that the comparative weak growth limits
Can you adjust the mic, Honourable Member? Thank you.
Yeah, I think you indicated that, I think you highlighted the wide range of challenges that are facing us in terms of the issue of the economy, the decline in terms of growth, I mean, the decline in the economy, that our economy is not growing. Also, you made mention of the fact that the comparative weak growth limits capital flow. I think highlighting from 2015 coming this side, but also from 20, I think we've also experienced a decline again from 2018 to 2019. And that the rise, I think because of these challenges, we've seen the rise in government debts that also deepen the current account deficit as interest payments are become more high. Now, but also you made mention that in the previous quarter of 2019, which is between April and June, we've seen some rebound. So, well, my question is, how do we sustain this rebound? Or maybe to take it further, what needs to be done perhaps to turn the whole situation around? Well, I've also seen some projections that were made that we might see a slow projected recovery perhaps between 2019 to 2021. In 2019, starting at 0.6%, up to 2.0%. What would inform that if we are going to get that slow recovery? What will inform that? And what is it that we need to do actually just to turn the whole situation around? The second question on the issue of preferential procurement. I think I can see that you indicated that. On the BBBE, there's a performance progression from 2015-16, which was at 18.4 points, to 19 points in 2018-2019, which is quite good. I think we appreciate that. I just want to check on the SMMEs. I can see that we are saying there's an inclusive procurement that targets some of the its procurement spends on the qualifying small enterprise suppliers. I just want to know how do you do that and how do you balance the issue of big business and small business, just to make sure that the small business, they also get quite a sizable share in the entire procurement. Do you have set aside or what? How do you balance that? On the last question on the human resource highlight, I think we've indicated that there's a regrettable turnover ratio of 1.32% in the financial year 2018-19, which is up from 1.17 from the financial year 2017-18. What is quite a small percentage, but I think we would like to know as to what informs that. Do you hold exit interviews just to understand if people are resigning, what could be the risk? Reserve Bank is quite a big institution that people are aspiring to work in it. So if you find a person resigning, I think it would be interesting to see what could be the reason for their exit. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable
Mabile. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Governor. I spoke about getting our domestic environment right. I just want to find out, based on what is happening currently in the country, how is the confidence of the investors? Should we be worried? And also welcome the social investment support, more especially of bazaaries. But I'm just interested to know, do you make follow-ups of the recipients, where they are after they've completed, where are they working, how you can help them? And also, I think related to that one, you know, the digital banking, I can just sit here now and open my app and do everything. I don't have to go into the bank. So now it is obvious that those who are studying towards or envisaging to go and work in the bank now, some of them we know already they have left. And how are the institutions, are they talking to that one? What is it that they are studying now? Because now you can give them a bursary based on the, you know, future, I mean, the past, but you find that when they go to the banks, they also have to, you know, the fourth industrial revolution. How do you, and where are they now, those that have left the things in the 50s? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Mabilisa. Honorable Morlong, did you hear the
I
thought you heard the
No, thank you very much.
No, thank you very much, Chair. I think firstly we must commend the Reserve Bank for its poor protection when it comes to inflation. However, Governor, there is a view that when the Reserve Bank cuts interest rates to stimulate the economy, the money does not filter into the economy because of strictest capital lending requirements by the banks. What is your take on it?
Thank you, Honorable Moroleng. Honorable Shivam.
No, thank you, Acting Chair. I want to check the exact amount of that has been transferred to the National Revenue Fund from your profits. How much money did you transfer? Because I think the law says you must do that. And does the transfer of the percentage of your profits apply to the profits generated from African Bank? Because it's a business which maybe in certain instances might need reinvestment or other interventions from the profits. Do you do that with the profits that are generated from African Bank? And can you give us a clearer overview of your procurement space? What is the percentage of black suppliers of all goods and services that the Reserve Bank utilizes? What is the percentage of black and white suppliers? I hope that will come out here, because the manner in which it's presented is not very clear. So when we were there at the bank, you said you are internally responsible for 80% of asset management of the reserves. Who are the external asset managers, and what process was followed to appoint them? Are there black asset managers as part of those that are externally managing the foreign or the reserves? The fourth question is, did you play any role in the process that led to the so-called surprise economic policy of National Treasury, the crazy document of the Minister of Finance? Were you involved in conceptualizing that? Because I think in one of the meta statements, the Reserve Bank is mentioned there that as part of the colloquiums, the Reserve Bank was participating. I want to understand, what was your role and what contribution did you make? And the last question is, one of the recently resigned deputy governors, the CEO of Discovery Bank, Francia, I don't know how to pronounce his name, so I don't know how to do it. Doesn't that leave some discomfort in terms of principles and conflict and everything as they... Doesn't it amount to a javelin where you participate in giving a banking license to Discovery, which, if competition laws were to be thoroughly looked into, is conflicted because its owners are the owners of FirstRand. That's a fact. It's not an opinion. It's a fact that, and then 6 months later you come as the CEO of such a bank. It's one of the things like that we'll have to then deal with that. Aren't we now creating javelin arrangements in the Reserve Bank where if you want to resign, you first sort yourself outside so that you can go and catch outside what you have prepared this side. So you sell your license to yourself this side, and then you go that side to buy it so that you benefit in terms of the whole thing. So those are the questions that want to be responded to.
Thank you very much, Honorable Member, the Governor, any response?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Very good questions. I will see how I am going to distribute them, and then I will. When would you deal with the drivers of growth? As I go through, I will say who will deal with what. So, we'll deal with the one on the drivers of growth over the medium term. Reserve accumulation, Honorable Lewis. There are various motives for accumulating reserves. You do not have to have reserves because you are going to use them to intervene. You can hold reserves for precautionary purposes. And actually, for a country that has got a floating exchange rate, the economic literature used to say, why do you even need reserves? The most sanguine of the central banks on holding reserves used to be the Reserve Bank of New Zealand. But over the past 10 years, they too have started to accumulate reserves. And it has to do with the fact that players in the market look at you and say, should there be a dislocation of market, would the central bank have the means to restore the functioning of a market? So it becomes an insurance, so to say. So you know you have it, and you do not have to claim or make up a claim. So in other words, the fact that we have reserves does not mean that we must go and intervene. And that is why we would be holding reserves. The second aspect has to do with, we talked about the resilience to external shocks. And one of the key things that come that we emerging markets have to deal with is the possibility of what is called a sudden stop of capital flows. That if there is a sudden stop of capital flows, and would you still continue to be able to have functioning markets in that state? And one of the things that is then clearly very carefully watched is not just that you have reserves, is how big those reserves are with respect to future forex commitment. How much debt will be falling due? What is the current account deficit that you have? And because you have got a current account deficit, that must be financed. If there is a sudden stop, would you be able to finance it? And the countries then hold reserves on that basis. The intervention thing, and I'm glad because you said that we do not intervene. So the way in which we accumulate reserves, we do not accumulate reserves because we are trying to manipulate the exchange rate. So we are tended to accumulate reserves when there are big FDI transactions, which if allowed to just go through the market could lead to huge swings in financial markets. And what we normally do is to engage the players involved and smooth that by taking some of the foreign exchange that comes from there and bringing it into our the audit of the bullion reserves. There are two things. The first is an internal audit one. And you say that you would like to see the audit report. I think the simplest thing would be to give you the audit certificates. We're quite happy to ask the auditors to issue a certificate to say this, during the audit, these are the bullion reserves and we are satisfied about where they are held and so forth. That is what we would like to do. And Naidu, you will deal with the African thing of just to say that I need to state this because you said the African bank profit. The profit of African banks that reflects here is new African banks. It's the good bank. It's not the
bad bank.
It's not the bad bank. So those, that book that you are referring to is stayed behind in the bad bank with the debt collection services. But Naidu can always deal with what else went through that. As I go through this thing, I'm trying to. Honorable Judge, the thing about the engagement with government on the economy, it links to what Honorable Shibambo had raised with respect to the role we played in the National Treasury document. No, we have played no role in the National Treasury document. Remember, if you look at many of our MPC statements, we have been calling for the implementation of structural reform. And time in, time out, people ask us, but exactly what do you want? And we refused to get into it because it is the preserve of government to come with us. I do, my channel of engagement with government is either through the president and through the Minister of Finance. The Minister of Finance and I meet to exchange views on the on the economy, and I can say that on the issues of confidence, him and I are at one. That we need to lift the confidence. So, I wish it's tempting, you know, especially when you are a former DG of the Treasury, it's tempting to want to offer the advice, but I have been able to restrain myself. Part of it has been that some of the amendments done to the Reserve Bank Act when after the adoption of the Constitution removed a clause in the Reserve Bank Act. There used to be a clause in the Reserve Bank Act that said, the Reserve Bank shall be the primary economic advisor to the government. That clause was removed. And at the time when it was removed, there was a lot of unhappiness in the central bank. With hindsight, goodness, I think that the authors of the Constitution were ahead of us in saying, you're going to act independently, you stay out of this now. It's somebody else's job. And then, how can we sustain the rebound? Honorable Scott, Rashad, finally something you must answer. You also asked the issue about the exit interviews and how we do conduct exit interviews. Sometimes people tell you what they want you to hear. They will tell you how great the institution is and how it's just that I got this offer that I couldn't turn down, and so forth and so forth. And what we do is that we follow that up. We use some of the recruitment agencies that we use when we recruit to say, can you talk to this person anonymously? And they would then give us a different view. The interesting thing for me, which is an interesting thing, is the number of people who have left the Reserve Bank and returned. So, which then suggests that either it is not that green that side, or they realize that we are actually a better employer. And if they come and they come to the point and say that we are a better employer, they would not be far off. We have consistently for the past 4 years been rated as a preferred employer of choice by graduates. Consistently in the top three, that graduates say that this is the institution they would prefer to work for. And the interesting thing is that this past year we were at number two, and ahead of us was Google. How is the investor confidence? Well, we attempt to measure it through that survey that is done by the Bureau of Economic Research, but it measures domestic investor sentiment. It doesn't deal with foreign investor sentiment. Unfortunately, we do not have any survey about foreign investor sentiment. We do try to monitor the flows, because the foreign investors, they vote with the rest. The ones who are portfolio investors, they would either be selling South African assets or buying South African assets, but that becomes volatile because it's portfolio. The important thing to watch is FGI and whether we are seeing a rise in FGI in South Africa, and we are still, our FGI levels are actually still low compared to that of our peers. And I guess that is why the president went on this big investment drive, and hopefully he manages to get the bazaars, and whether we follow up. It's a challenge now that everybody faces, that almost when you talk to companies, they tell you that the recruits that they have from universities end up having to be retrained. But at least they would have demonstrated something. They have demonstrated that they are capable of mastering a body of knowledge. So training them in another area, so these are people capable of learning, and then so they can be transitioned. But the stuff about the fourth industrial revolution is moving so fast. I mean, I'll give you this idea. So we have in the Reserve Bank foreign exchange traders. They monitor the foreign exchange market. They speak to people constantly throughout the day. They monitor the screens of what is actually happening. This weekend, we had a presentation in Basel by two central banks that are saying they are now using machine learning to monitor foreign exchange markets. And why do they need foreign exchange machine learning? Because so many of the trades that are taking place in the foreign exchange market now take place through an algorithm. So if a machine trading with another machine is not individual, and so you need another machine to monitor that kind of activity, and that is how quickly these things are moving. And if I had this discussion with my foreign exchange here, says where do I buy one of these machines? I said, well, buying the machine is one thing. Somebody must program it, and that says that I would be needing data scientists, programmers, and people who understand artificial intelligence and machine learning. And it's a whole different world, out there. And employers are going to be faced with this challenge, that we are not going to get ready-made people coming out of the universities. And that is why you see that we have got actually such a huge training spend budget. We have got to do that.
I will come back to the procurement stuff just now. And Rashad, can you talk about this thing of money after rate cut, money not filtering down to people? Because you can also help. That's great. Honorable Shibamba, I think that the thing about the profits of African banks, it's an interesting one. Those profits are not, that we have attributable, is not dividends declared to the bank. It's a consolidation. So it's the profits on the balance, on the income statement of African banks that are a share of the Reserve Bank. African Bank has still not declared dividends because they are still on their resolution mode. So it would not include those profits. And Kuben, you have the figures of what we transferred to the Reserve Bank, to the Treasury this year, and we will go through that that stuff. Reserve management, as we have said, that 80% is managed in-house, the 20% is managed outside. The breakdown of that, I don't know if Fundi has the exact percentages, but we use official institutions, the BIS and the World Bank, and there is a portion that is allocated according to instruments. So we have got people who have our liquid portfolio, so they have got to track that. So you've got to demonstrate that Fundi might have that that breakdown, and we'll give you that breakdown. There aren't South African based asset management companies in that reserve. The thing of conflict, I agree with you. Of people who leave the central bank, the thing that the central banks confront with, the question is how do you manage that risk? So in the U.S. is too laissez-faire. People walk out and they walk in next door immediately. In our case, our policy is that you can't move within 6 months of you leaving the bank. So we put you on a cooling off period of 6 months. Now, understandably, we put these things, our predecessors were older than us, and most of the time when they left, they retired. You are having young executives now who, when they leave, they will most likely be looking for a job. And one of the things that our board remuneration committee started to ask was, is this 6 months adequate? Should we be looking for a period longer than 6 months? If we look for a period longer than 6 months, how far do we go? At the moment, we do pay people for that 6 month period, so we say to them, you can't take a job because we are paying you. So any other suggestion of how this transition can be managed is welcome. But it's not just that it gives rise to conflict. Even if it didn't give rise to conflict, the very thing that people could perceive it to be a conflict is exactly the reason why it should be dealt with. The Discovery First Rand shareholding Kubera can walk you through that as a condition they have to pass.
Thank you.
Sure,
thank you. On the African bank, those profits are from the government, right? So that's how income statement from the government.
My apologies. The profits from that are reported in the income statement are from Good Bank. As at the 31st of March 2018, the NCR investigations into lending into the bad book required us to write 67 million rand off. However, these investigations are ongoing. I don't have a firm figure for 31st of March 2019, but my estimate is that it's around 30 million. So just to refresh your memory, there's about 5 billion rand of collections that we've got to make, and we've had to write off 67 million to date. That's the firm number. It's probably about another 30 million in the last financial year. So in total, about 97 million. We've had to write off because of reckless lending. We don't conduct that investigation. It's an NCR investigation, and it's an ongoing investigation. The NCR is continuously looking at the book. So far from the reports that have been issued by the NCR, we've written off 67 million. Chair, it is true that when banks have to raise more capital or hold more capital, or there are regulatory requirements that require them to hold more capital, it does affect the transmission from interest rates into lending. It is true. It is not the case in the last 3 or 4 years. The bulk of the increase in capital that had to be held by banks in terms of Basel III was largely completed by 2013-2014. So there was an increase in capital that the banks had to hold as a result of Basel III. They do have to comply with the liquidity coverage ratio and the net stable funding ratio, and that does impact on bank cost of capital. There's no doubt about it. the bulk of those increases in cost of capital probably peaked somewhere around 2013, 2014, and have been pretty stable since then. There hasn't been a discernible increase that we've imposed from a regulatory point of view on bank cost or bank cost of capital. So we don't think that going forward, at least for the last 4 or 5 years plus going forward, that this provides a disincentive for banks to lend or to translate a repo rate hike or cut into the real economy. Chair, on profits to the government, let me qualify this by 3 points. The first is that the law, the South African Reserve Bank Act, allows the SARB to keep aside certain statutory reserves and contingency reserves so that we prevent a situation where the Reserve Bank is running in what's called negative equity. After the financial crisis, when yields were very low, we were actually making losses. We made losses for several years, and it's only the last 3, 4, maybe 5 years that we've started to make profits. And so there's in some ways we're rebuilding those reserves. In the last financial year ending 31 March, we transferred 249 million rand to government as a dividend. That's out of the 6-odd billion rand. Transfer the surplus to government. I think it's also important to make the point that in some ways the entire balance sheet of the SARB is there for government. Right? I mean, we manage reserves which are on the SARB's balance sheet, but those reserves belong to the country. The entire profits of the SARB are due to government in a direct or indirect way. The need to build up a contingency reserve is to prevent the SARB from running negative equity. Our sense is that we probably have to continue to build up that reserve for at least another 5, 6, 7 years before you get a larger proportion of the profits being paid over to government. But it's in the financial statements. It's all there about what profits we want to take. General, I just want to make a comment on Deputy Governor Groop. I think you're absolutely correct, and there's nothing that I would change from your answer except one point, that Deputy Governor Groop played no role in the licensing of African Bank in a direct sense, Discovery Bank, or any other banking license. Banking licenses or insurance licenses, there's a specific governance process that actually excludes the governors from that process. So the Prudential Committee that oversees the African Bank, the Prudential Authority, does not get into the minutiae of deciding on who to allocate licenses to. There's a licensing panel. That licensing panel makes recommendations to the CEO of the Prudential Authority. The CEO of the Prudential Authority, based on the policy framework set by the Prudential Committee, issues licenses. But I fully agree that there is a problem. There's both the problem and the perception of a problem. And I think that the governors and the board of the SARB have to look at how we minimize that going forward.
Chair, let me just address the quick question on what has gone into our growth forecast when we had a discussion in the last MPC. So the main drivers of the small recovery over the next 2 years is, first of all, just the low base of growth. So if one looks at how low growth has been over the last 4 to 5 years, that means that you don't need to grow by a lot to get to achieve growth rates of around 2%. So capital replacement by corporates, just to sustain the capital levels that they have, would be one of the drivers. We've made some assumptions around job creation. Yes, the levels are low and they remain low, but there is some level of job creation in the economy. So as others are losing jobs, others are getting into employment. There's still some level of income growth that sustains household consumption. That is also an element, and we have had some healthy levels of credit growth. Not very high, but there is still an element of credit growth. So those factors, as well as some relative positive levels of in terms of trade. So that is affected by commodity prices that are rising for some commodities that we still have in our economy. So those are the drivers of growth. But as you mentioned earlier, these are very low levels of growth and not sufficient. So at the moment, we're talking about growth rates between 1.8 and 2%. So going into the next forecast period, we would then have to review this. One of the elements that would have an impact on the forecast would also be what is happening to global growth. So that's an area that we would look at going forward. But what we've signaled in our forecast is that there are some downside pressures to growth that are there, and they're quite significant. So it is possible that if these downside factors do continue to materialize, we might see growth that is slightly lower.
Thank you very much. One or two questions. The first is, you know, how do we recover or sustain the recovery? I mean, I'll first give you a kind of a statistical response and then an economic response. When one looks at quarterly GDP numbers, the one problem we have is when you measure the economy at a quarterly frequency, there's a lot of volatility in the numbers. So statistically, you know, there's some meaning in what a quarterly number means, but in reality, you know, it could be a statistical artifact. So, for example, when we had a negative 3% of GDP in the previous quarter, which really was really dragged down by investment, you had a sudden recovery of investment in the next quarter, and that recovery of investment contributed to a nice GDP. In our view, that is not a real recovery. It's really just a negative quarter that's contracted, and you're just normalizing from a negative quarter. Now, one thing, ironically, that does happen is when firms see that the GDP has improved, that's a bit self-reinforcing. It kind of creates a bit of confidence, so we see there's improvement, we're going to increase our orders and so on. So the idea of it all is a positive number has some kind of reinforcing, self-fulfilling effect. But in order to, you know, to sustain the quarterly GDP, it's quite important that you know, that some of the short-term factors like increase in credit growth, the improved investment environment coming from investment numbers in the first quarter are the kind of things that can contribute. I think that the positive message we take out of the recent GDP numbers is that we're not in recessionary territory, but we're not in out of the hoods, and our forecast for 2019 for the state of unemployment we have in the economy is abysmal. I mean, we're still at 0.6. I can't see us revising that fundamentally for 2019. Just one point on the impact of an interest rate cut or monetary policy on the poor. There's a very, you know, there's a burgeoning literature in the last couple of years about the relationship between monetary policy and income distribution and so on. I mean, the irony of it all is that, you know, when we cut interest rates, the majority of people we're relying on to stimulate the economy are not the poor. We're actually relying on the middle class, who have mortgages, who take loans, who borrow. And the moment, you know, there's a decrease in interest rates, they do one of two things. You pay more of your mortgage, so you deleverage, or you spend a bit more. And by spending a bit more, you're actually stimulating demand, and by stimulating demand, you know, you create jobs. So the channel through which a cut in interest rate affects the poor is, ironically, those who can afford to spend more. They bring their consumption forward when you cut the interest rate. In the U.S., it's a whole different story. There, they rely very heavily on asset prices, which is kind of seen as kind of more elitist. Just one question, Honorable MP, on the question of digital. The one thing that I think worries us enormously, and it's something that's an issue in the economy, is you'll find that many corporates now have this kind of future of work theme. And the big issue there is that even in I, for example, used to be the head of economic research and statistics, and we would train people to do econometrics. But in fact, now you have machine learning who can do it very easily. So the irony is all about the whole future of work. It's not the poor who are a threat only, but actually working middle class people with skills are a threat. And central banks, for example, are employing more data scientists than they're employing economists. For example, you know, we're looking for people with, for the first time in my previous capacity as head of economic research and statistics, we were looking for data scientists more than we were looking for economists, so people with computer science and economic degrees to do these kind of things. So I think we do have a real challenge that there are going to be, at one level we have this economy with very differential productivities, unskilled people, particularly in the informal sector. At another level, we have to really have to keep up to maintain our competitiveness. And I think this is a big theme that we all should worry about, how the future of work is affecting the skills and whether we're gearing up for that.
Okay. You know, members, any follow-ups? Honorable Lewis, Honorable Fofana, and Honorable Shivam, in that order.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Naidu, for that clarification. Can I just ask, where is the profit from the bad bank reflected on your balance sheet and income statement, and how much was it? And I'm very thrilled to hear that you've written off 97 million rand, or rather 67 million with a further 30 coming soon. What I'd like to know is, what percentage of the book, the 4.5 billion, if I remember correctly, it's 4.2 billion, has been checked? In other words, the 100 million you've written off could be a proportion of a billion, or it could be a proportion of the full amount. I'd like to know what that proportion is. Thank you.
No, thanks, Honorable Chair. There's just one question which was not answered about the set aside for SMMEs.
Honorable Chairman.
No, thank you, Chair. So the National Treasurer issued a statement on the 20th of January 2019. It says that the Minister of Finance, Tito Mboweni, convened the second colloquium on the South African economy to discuss ways to achieve higher and more inclusive growth. Participants of the colloquium included the Minister of Trade and Industry, Rob Davies, Governor of the South African Reserve Bank, Lesitsha Khanyago, and Deputy Governor Daniel Mnimeli, academics, private sector economists, key government officials, business people, and international experts. So that is why the Harvard group, but it says you were involved there. You are saying you're not involved. Who is not telling the truth? Because it says, that is what the statement of National Treasury says, that you are involved in formulating a policy position which is extremely problematic. So you must give us a clearer picture in terms of what has been your role. Like, if you're involved, you must say, I was involved, this is what I contributed, so that we can then be able to interact with you based on what your contributions are. Maybe let's rephrase the question on procurement. How much do you spend on procurement, and who are the suppliers of the goods and services that the Reserve Bank need? And what is the racial composition of that? I think that maybe will... I did not get a response to that. And then maybe just the last issue is, does your national payment system have capacity to monitor e-commerce of businesses that are not here? Let's say when we buy through Amazon and Uber, do you have capacity to monitor the money movements in that space? That is one of the questions which I think even when we were at the bank, we couldn't get clarity on.
Thank you. Honorable Morolong?
Well, do you mind talking to me for a new question? Recently, Governor, I think you have switched off the wrong microphone.
Well, recently the banks admitted to the fixing of the rent. We would want to know what were the fines levied, and generally what is the process of consequence management.
Thank you. I had said I was going to deal with the procurement questions last, and then we opened the round before I could get to that. But I might be having competition if somebody wanted to deal with it. Okay, so the biggest procurement that we have is loads and quantities. So there is no scope there. We get that from our subsidiaries. Straightforward. We spent 1.8 billion rand on the black-owned businesses for the year under review, and 300 million rand on the other businesses that included international. We must talk in percentage, but these are not big amounts. This man here, he doubles up as the chair of the budget committee, so you might want to add color to that. Honorable Shivambo, the statement of the treasury is in January is right, but that is not. This document was not produced by this document has been doing the rounds from last year, long before the colloquium was convened. First colloquium was convened in December, and the second one was convened in January. The person who communicated what they did in the document, yes, they did. There are citations there of one or two documents that were from the Treasury, but these are from the Reserve Bank, but those were citations, not because we were... It's tempting for me to want to be involved in it. Now, I guess we can comment, because the Treasury has called for comment. I guess we can comment, but it's not the document that we were involved in. And then, dealing with the process of the bad book again, the capacity of the National Payment System in monitoring e-commerce. At the moment, it's a real-time gross settlement system. So we see the gross amount. The cross-border ones, which tend to be seen by both SARC and financial surveillance, not through the national payment system. There is a big discussion now about the role when you get into the retail, but I guess that to monitor that might not be that difficult. What is going to have to take is that it's going to have to take SARS and them to call for the record from that. But the national payment system has not been designed to do that. It's a gross system. So what we see are gross amounts rather than the individual.
Just to add one thing, Governor, I think that the foreign surveillance would have had track records of people spending money abroad and ordering
not domestic.
Abroad. Yeah.
Okay. And then the other one, the fixing of the rent and the fine. As soon as the Competition Commission started that investigation, before they, and we have got a memorandum of understanding, before they could announce anything that they are doing with a regulated institution, they come to talk to us. They came to talk to us, and they gave us a lowdown, and they said, these are the things that are happening. And then we asked them how we could help them. And we cooperated with them, and we gave them information to the extent we can. We even availed them with expertise, because this is a fairly specialized environment, to assist them in their investigation. But it's a process that is, I think it's gone to the tribunal now, and we will see the outcome from there, what the fines and consequences are.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, let me start by saying that the financial accounts of residual debt services are published. They're on the internet. Right? So you can just, it's actually on the African Bank website. There's a link to residual debt services, and you can get the statements. In fact, I've just seen the unaudited statements for 2019 are also there. Right? Let me take a step back on how Bad Book was constructed. So inside Bad Book, we put about 17 billion rands worth of loans, loans which we thought have a probability of collection somewhere between 25 and 33%. So there's about 17 billion rand of loans there. There is also all the subordinated and stub holder debt on that balance sheet, of which they will get. So the senior creditors got about 90 cents in the rand. The subordinated creditors will get about 33, 34 cents in the rand. But this is not designed to make a profit. Right? In fact, if you look at the accounts, it will make a loss. Right? It will never be able to pay those subordinated debt holders all that is due to them. Right? It is not the intention to ever pay all that is due to them. So there isn't a profit or a loss that then comes onto the SAB's balance sheet. The SAB is not the owner of residual debt services. In some ways, residual debt services, think of it as the shell of the old African Bank that is under curatorship. Right? It's an entity under curatorship, and both audited and unaudited financial statements every 6 months are published on the web in that sense. Collections on the Bad Book are going pretty well. We think that we will be able to collect around a third of that book. We think we'll be able to repay the SAB the money that we put in. We think that we'll be able to fully cover how much was agreed with the subordinated debt holders at the time of curatorship, maybe a couple of cents in the rand more, but probably not much more than that. And, of course, there has to be this contingency on any future legal costs. Right, which is part of the National Credit Regulator story, but also any other legal liability that Bad Book faces. So it's disclosed in the statements, Chair.
Because the question about the set-aside, we do not quite do the set-aside. We just measure how much we have spent on SMEs. In the previous year, it was 180 million. A consequence of our success is that in the year that we are reviewing now, the figure has dropped to 50 million, and the reason it has dropped to 50 million is that many of the black-owned and black-women-owned businesses graduated, so they are now, they do not count as SME, they count as, our cut-off is 50 million. Any tickets from above 50 million goes into the other category. We don't deem it to be SME.
If you could just deal with the, I understand that a third of the book will be collected. How much of the book has been audited for reckless credit?
Sorry, my apologies. I missed that one. I don't know. I think we'll have to ask the curator or the National Credit Regulator about how much of the book has been audited. I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay, Honourable Member, I think for now we can step off the interactions towards the presentation and maybe just thank the staff for that part. And we will also defer the vote of thanks to later and listen to the presentation by the Prudential Authority. Over to you, Governor.
The Prudential Authority was established from the 1st of April last year as a jurisdiction person. It operates within the administration of the SAP, made up of four departments, one looking at banking, insurance, and financial market infrastructure supervision, one that looks at the financial conglomerate supervision, and then it's also made up of two support departments, one that focuses on policy, statistics, and industrial support, and the fourth one is focused on risk support. And the focus of the PA is to achieve a safer financial system through excellence in prudential regulation and supervision. The PA team consists of 242 staff members with qualifications and experience in banking, insurance, actuarial science, law, policy, governance, commerce, and finance. You can already see we do not have the data scientists, and we are going to need them. The governance structure, we have got the Prudential Committee, which is a creation of the Financial Sector Regulations Act, which is responsible for the general oversight of the management and administration of the Prudential Authority to ensure that it is effective and efficient. And the Prudential Committee is basically the governor and the three deputy governors. The senior members of the, or the head of department of the Prudential Authority are in attendance, but they are not quite members of the Prudential Committee. The day-to-day operational operations and management of the PA is vested with a Prudential Authority Management Committee, which is basically the CEO of the Prudential Authority and the head of department of the Prudential Authority. We have dealt with effects from the 31st of March. We still have, we had a vacant position there. DG Groep resigned as deputy governor and member of the of the Prudential Committee. Mr. Minele retired on the 30th of June, and ex officio, then the two new deputy governors become members of the Prudential Committee. The Prudential Committee has made progress during the year. It has finalized and adopted a supervisory framework and certain elements of the regulatory and supervisory framework for financial conglomerates and significant owners have been distributed for external consultation. We've published the regulatory strategy, which is a requirement of the Financial Sector Regulations Act. It's a three-year regulatory strategy for 2018 to 2021. The implementation of the Insurance Act number 18 of 2017 and related prudential standards for insurance companies became effective on the 1st of July last year. Number of memoranda of understanding had been created. The Prudential Authority released its inaugural annual report for the on the 25th of June this year, and it is it has been tabled in Parliament in accordance with the procedures. The South African banking sector is dominated by five large banks, which collectively held 90.5% of the total banking sector assets as at the 31st of March 2019. Local branches of international banks accounted for 5.6% of the banking sector assets at the end of March 2019. Other banks represented 3.8% at the end of the same financial year. The liquidity of the banking system has also been solid. The liquidity coverage ratio is remained above the minimum requirement during the period under review and amounted to 142%, 0.4% at the end of March 2019, mainly due to an increase in high-quality liquid assets. This high-quality liquid asset is basically is predominantly a government bond. So what the liquidity coverage ratio has done is that it has made the banks to hold a lot of government paper, whether in the form of long bond and in the form of treasury bills. We also do have mutual banks. There are four mutual banks, or one is under liquidation. The sector remained profitable during the period under review, although a declining trend in profitability was evident. total mutual banking asset increased to 3.1 billion rands. The total capital adequacy ratio for the sector remained stable at 23.1%. Overdue loans improved to 6 million rand from 8 million rand the previous year. On the insurance side, we have got life insurers, non-life insurers, and composite insurers. The total assets for the life insurers are 3 trillion, and for the non-life insurers is 197 billion, and for the composite insurers 33 billion rand. The PA must, within a period of 2 years from the effective date of the 1st of July, convert the registration of all previously registered insurers to a license in accordance with the Insurance Act. We also oversee the cooperative financial sector. The cooperative banks have always been regulated by the SARB. But in terms of FISRA now, the PA now regulate both the cooperative financial institutions and cooperative banks, having taken over the regulatory oversight of the CFIs from the Cooperative Banks Development Agency in the Treasury. The CFIs reflected in the below, in the table below, were registered by the CBDA and are in the process of reapplying for registration with the Prudential Authority. We also oversee financial market infrastructure. This category includes the exchanges, central securities depositories, clearing houses, central counterparties, and trade depositories. And on the right there is the list of all of those entities that are classified as financial market infrastructure that we actually regulate. There is still an issue of illegal deposit taking. Unregulated insurance activities are split between the Prudential Authority and the Financial Sector Conduct Authority. The Prudential Authority investigates registered insurers that are conducting business or classes of policies that are not registered that they are not registered to deal with. FISCA investigates entities conducting business without being registered to do so. For the year under review, there were a number of investigations that had to be undertaken. Now, if any entity illegally takes deposits or characterizes itself as a bank, it would have been deemed to be in breach of the Banks Act. So, unregistered persons are prohibited from deposit-taking activities. For this period, we had 20 investigations that had been carried from the previous financial year. We had 2 new investigations and we finalized 16 investigations. Currently, there are 6 investigations underway. The SARB has got a responsibility as a resolution authority, but there are certain resolution management staff issues that take place within the Prudential Authority. The following entities were placed under curatorship during the period under review. VBS Mutual Bank was put under curatorship on the 11th of March and subsequently under liquidation in October 2018. Nzalo Insurance Services Limited and Bupilo Life Insurance Company Limited, provisional winding up on the 12th of February this year. The Insure Group Manager, which collects premiums for insurance, voluntary curatorship by the FISCA with the concurrence of the Prudential Authority, and Lion of Africa Insurance Company Limited license was suspended on the 13th of November last year. African Bank, the new African Bank, which was launched in 2016, continued to operate in a stable manner in the period under review. We have also received requests from potential buyers to purchase the bank, and any such proposal or proposals will be for the consideration of the shareholders, which include the SARB and the National Treasury. Where to next from here? We, the Prudential Authority, had eventually completed its first year. The current mandate includes all of those institutions that we had provided there, but a credit provider's Prudential is done through the National Credit Regulator and through the FISCA. For the period beyond the current regulatory strategy, runs from 2018 to 2021, so the next regulatory strategy will be for 2021 to 2024, possibility of pension funds, collective investment schemes, and friendly societies. During the next year, the PA will be implementing numerous prudential standards applicable to industries that it regulates. So that is the Prudential Authority, short and brief.
Didn't want to say short and sweet, Governor. Okay, thank you so much for that. Honourable members, can we take quick questions?
I think when we were there, the Reserve Bank, we asked for an overview on the transformation issues, and there was a commitment that is going to be made here in terms of the licenses that, and operating insurance licenses and banking licenses that are in black people's hands. That is what we've asked for, and I'm not seeing that there in terms of what happens. Because also it looks like even the insurance companies that are falling off the radar are the black-owned insurance companies. So what basically it means is that you are regulating a whites-only business environment for insurance and banks. And when there's no scope for participation of other people, and also the fee structure is prohibitive in terms of how much money is required for whoever wants to get a banking license to gain access to it, or an insurance license. Like, it's impossible. Like, I'm sure, like, amongst the 48 million black people in South Africa, 50 million black people in South Africa, there's possibly one person who can afford the 250 million to get a banking license, and that person has got a license already. But there are many of others that can easily get that. And it cannot be that 25 years into so-called democracy, the certain sectors of the economy are still exclusively white in terms of control and ownership. It's one of the things that the Reserve Bank in a so-called democratic society should think about in terms of what happens. And the other issue is that I think there are systemic risks to the manner in which, certain banks issue out credit. Like, there are systemic risks in the manner in which credit. So there are potential risks even to the manner in which. And we are not regulating credit granting by Capitec. Not only them, but all other institutions that issue out credit. There are lots of systemic risks because you can say, no, while credit is not our area of surveillance or regulation, but what if a bank borrows out money more than what it can sustain internally in terms of what is required, than its entire set, and continues to roll over those loans like Capitec is doing? What then becomes your role in terms of that dynamic? Because it's one of the issues. And the, of major concern, by the way, it's not whether the owners of Capitec have got a lot of money and everything else. It's the enslavement which they subject our people to, of binding people to unlawful said it, like they owe the bank forever, like in an unlawful way, like, and then they keep on piling, like they borrow you 5,000 rand when it's due, when you cannot pay, they borrow you 6,000 rand to pay the 5,000, like that, and it doesn't end in terms of what happens. So this, but also even from a macro point of view, in terms of how the bank generally gets to then deal with its own systems, there are systemic issues that speak to that. And I don't think that we must ignore that. You can, of course, disregard correctly viceroy reports, but there are fundamental issues that arise from other observations that point to systemic risks in relation to some of these credit providers.
Member, another question?
Thanks, Honorable Acting Chair, and we appreciate the presentation by the Governor. Now, Governor, since the provincial authority, in one way or the other, is part of the South African Reserve Bank, are there any employment duplication of people who are working at South African Reserve Bank, also saving as at the provincial authority, or others maybe saving at the financial sector product authority and also saving at the prudential authority? Are there any employment duplication? If they are, how do you manage them? And the second question, who are the permanent members of the prudential committee? How many are they and who are they? And the last question, are there any measures put in place to reduce bureaucracy and red tapes in the way financial institutions are really regulated? Thanks.
Thanks, Honorable Skotana. Maybe just staffing on the question that Honorable Skotana raised on the staffing, the composition rather, of the Prudential Authority. I see that in your annual report for the current year, the structure consists of the governor and three deputy governors, and there's a vacancy there. Doesn't seem there's an effort to fill it in with women. I don't know, you can talk for yourself, Governor, because on page 9, the structure once again of the management committee has got just one woman. And if you can please talk to that. Otherwise, in terms of other questions, just two or three, I see that in your presentation you say that the usual bank assets increased to 3.1. You don't say from what, because on the same page you did talk about the overdue loans that have improved to 6 million, while in 2018 they were 8. So I'd like to get clarity on that. And in terms of the capital adequacy ratio, it says it's 23.10 for SA Bank percent. What should the minimum be? Is it adequate? What should the minimum be?
Thank you. I think the Prudential Committee is the creature of the Financial Sector Regulation Act. So it says it's the governor and the three deputies. So that vacancy got filled when that vacancy got filled by the woman. We can do better. We must accept that bit. The letter from the committee said that we are dealing with the annual report. Didn't talk about the transformation of the sector. If the committee would like us to answer specific questions on transformation, we can deal with that. If we were told that we must do a presentation on the transformation, we would have done so.
Chairperson,
you want
to say something?
No, I'm saying that when we raised the issue of transformation at the Reserve Bank, a commitment was made that we are coming on the 11th. We'll make it there. So it was a natural expectation because a commitment was made there.
Well, we will deal with the question. The letter didn't talk about what we have. And by the way, yes, we are here. We can deal with it to the extent that we can deal with the information that we are having. So if we were told that, because it was the presentation, specifically said presentation by the staff, presentation on the PA, but we will deal with that. The stuff about systemic risks that come from credit, we've got to distinguish two things. We have got to distinguish conduct issues in the credit market and the nature of the books of the regulated entities that are depicting problems of credit risk. So if it is a bank and has got unsustainable books which are reflected in either non-performing loans and all of that, we deal with that from a prudential perspective. If the bank is acting and lending recklessly, it's a conduct issue. Yes, conduct issues could lead to prudential issues because when the conduct regulator acts on those conduct issues, shareholders and depositors look at these things and they worry. And so that is why we had to have this understanding with the National Credit Act. I think that we had dealt with this thing because your question in Pretoria was why is the other one at that side, and we spelled out that it was above our pay grade. The decision was taken elsewhere. What about Skosana? The issue of employment and duplication, the PA, the Act says that the Reserve Bank must avail resources to the Prudential Authority, including human resources. So the Prudential Authority itself does not quite employ people. The people are employed by the Reserve Bank and availed to the Prudential Authority. So they don't have their own HR department, they use the Reserve Bank HR department. You could see their finances are basically like a note in the books of the, in the annual report of the Reserve Bank. So they operate under the administration, so there is no duplication. And there is no duplication with FISCA either. However, FISCA does provide that should any of the regulators involved feel that they need resources that are with another regulator, there is a provision that we can second staff across. So FISCA can second staff to the Prudential Authority, the Prudential Authority can second staff to the FISCA, and that is done at an operational level. So that is not the problem. The other thing, the CEO have got your name written all over.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, let me deal with the three substantive issues that Mr. Shivambu raises. Let me first start off on the unsecured lending issue. Mr. Shivambu, I agree with you. I think as a country we've got a problem. I think a very large proportion of South Africans are overly indebted. I think we've got what I would call a consumer indebtedness problem. People are in debt at very high interest rates, and it is like theft, as you say. You have loans of 20,000 rand at an effective interest rate approaching 100%. You're trapped forever. I fully agree with you. I don't think that there's consensus on what we do about it. There are two broad schools of thought on what we do about it. The one school of thought is that we must curb the supply of credit. because supply is inducing demand. Right? So either we prevent banks from lending into the market, or we limit the interest rate at which people can lend in the market, we ration credit. So that's the one school of thought. And it's an argument that in some ways is quite powerful. It's a bit like gambling, right? Supply induces demand. If you've got a casino on every street corner, you're likely to get a bigger gambling problem than if you have to drive 40 k's to go to a casino. It has the same effect on poor people in some ways. Right? The other school of thought is that that's not the right way, because that merely forces people into an unregulated underworld that is even worse, where the interest rates are even higher and the collection methods are even more violent. Right? And those are the two, that's the debate. And I think as a society we need to have this debate. Right? What do we do about this consumer indebtedness problem that South Africa faces? Right? As a regulator, a relatively small share of the unsecured lending market is in the banking sector, a relatively small share. We have higher capital adequacy ratios for the unsecured lenders, for the monoline unsecured lenders. In fact, when Capitec came, I think it was in this room, when they were talking about the lending to the Marikana strikers, for example, or the father fireman, they disclosed their capital adequacy ratio. Their capital requirement, their level of capital was 34%. They disclosed that. I won't say what the minimum requirement is because we don't disclose that. But they disclosed that. If you look at Standard Bank or APSA, their capital ratios are around 15-16%. So there are higher requirements on the unsecured lenders, partly to prevent the kind of systemic risk that you're talking about. We've also been criticized that because we have such high capital adequacy ratios on the monoline unsecured lenders, they're forced into what they call high interest rate, high risk lending with a high default rate. It's not just Capitec. African Bank in many ways is still a monoline unsecured lender. UBank is still a monoline unsecured lender. There are many institutions in South Africa that are banks that are regulated by us. We believe that we've got a capital framework and a prudential framework that prevents systemic risk to the sector, that prevents depositors' funds from getting lost. But it doesn't deal with the social problem that Mr. Shirombo raises. I think for that we need a broader discussion and a broader set of solutions, because there is genuinely no consensus on exactly what to do about it. As a regulator, if we can play a role in helping to solve that problem, we'll be more than willing to. I'm not sure if the best solution is to kick the banks out of that market. It might just make the situation worse for those who are the most vulnerable. In fact, Mr. Shambu, there's a report that was released on the 27th of October, of August, by a company called Differential Capital. It's entitled "Unsecured Lending Has Consumers Sliding Towards Financial Ruin. How Do We Reverse Course?" So it's quite a damning indictment on the unsecured lending industry, and it proposes some pretty good solutions about how to turn it around. Right? I'm not endorsing the report. I think it's very useful information that could inform the policy debate. Chair, on the transformation of the financial sector, you're correct, Mr. Shambu. When you came to the Reserve Bank, we did say that we will be able to answer any questions you have on transformation there. So I have here both the Financial Sector Charter Council annual report and the BASA report on banking transformation. They point out several positive trends and several negative trends. On ownership, as a country, we've slipped backwards. So black ownership of the banking sector has fallen by about 1 or 2 percentage points from 4 or 5 years ago. Largely as the second generation BEE deals have expired, some people have sold. So at an ownership level, we've fallen backwards. In several other areas, we've made significant progress. Black management, black senior management, number of directors. In some areas, that progress has been too little. So 1 in 10 directors are black women. Right? And the numbers are there all in the report, where we're not making sufficient progress. But the report, in both the Financial Sector Charter Council report and the BASA report, provide a fairly detailed and fine-grained picture of where we're making progress in transformation and where we're not. We are doing better on lending to what's called the township economy, but off a very low base. We are not doing well in lending to women-owned businesses. That's an area where the sector needs to do well. The sector is spending much more money in affirmative procurement or empowered procurement. Right? There's a lot more resources going into it. And all of that is documented and detailed. Chair, I'll conclude this part of the answer by saying that for 15 years we had what I would call stasis in licensing. The licenses that we have issued in the last 3 or 4 years on both the banking and the insurance front have not yet dramatically changed the picture of the financial sector landscape, but they are a step in the right direction. They are progress. We had no new banking licenses issued for 11 years. In fact, the only 2 banking licenses issued in the last 15 years was African Bank twice. We have now issued new licenses, both black-owned and historically white-owned. Right? We think that it is both necessary to deconcentrate the financial sector and to transform the financial sector from a racial and gender point of view. And we think we are making slow but steady progress. After very little, almost nothing happening for 15 years, we are taking steps. If you look at the cooperative banks, the cooperative financial institutions, in the insurance space, there are several black insurers that are licensed, and many of them are doing well. On the insurance front, the Insurance Act specifically allows for what I call the progressive realization of the capital requirements. So there are several black-owned insurance companies who don't meet the minimum capital requirements. We're working with them. We've given them 3 or 4 years to get up to the minimum level of capital requirements in order to diversify and transform the sector. So, Chair, I think we can criticize and we can make reference to the fact that we are not moving fast enough. I would make the point that we are making progress where progress has not been made in 15 to 20 years in transforming the financial sector, but a lot still needs to be done. Chair, on the amount of money that it costs for banking licenses, that is in the Banks Act. As I've said, if I were to rewrite the Banks Act, I would lower those amounts. I would include more rungs in the ladder. At the moment, you've got, $2 million for a cooperative financial institution, $10 million for a mutual bank of deposits, $250 million minimum capital requirement for a bank. If I were to rewrite the Banks Act tomorrow, I would put in more rungs. Both Nigeria and India have introduced the concept of payment banks, which are what they call limited liability in financial institutions. There are rungs along that ladder, right, that allow people to enter the payment system, that allow people to enter the financial sector with lower capital requirements. They're still broadly regulated within a broad framework that's not very dissimilar to Basel, but they're lower requirements. Right. Chair, on reckless lending, to make the point that I would have no sympathy if the NCR has to do what it has to do in terms of its law. Right? There is reckless lending and they must deal with that in the harshest possible way. On the mutual bank assets, the assets went from $3 billion up to $3.1 billion. It was a 4.4% increase. And Chair, on the capital adequacy ratio for mutual banks, we stand at an average of 23. The minimum requirement is 12.5, and so we think it's fairly good. We have different capital requirements depending on the business model for the banks. Chair, there's a question about reducing bureaucracy and red tape in the way in which we regulate banks. It's a very fine line between being lighter on the smaller banks in order to promote inclusion and diversity and preventing the kind of problems that we had in VBS. If we, in general, in most countries in the world, small banks are supervised in what I would call a mechanistic fashion. They send in data. We rely on the audited reports. We visit them once a year. They come and see us once a year. They do a presentation. It's generally pretty light touch because they're not systemic. In most countries in the world, there's deposit insurance. If they go under, the social costs are relatively low. That's the way in which we approach the supervision of small banks in general, up until VBS. We have had to change our approach. We have had to become much more intrusive. We have had to have more checks and balances on the board, on the governance, on the audit committee, on the chair of the audit committee, on the external auditors, on the internal auditors. So we have had to raise the regulatory bar on these small institutions in order to prevent the kinds of failures, because we've seen the political fallout of the collapse of UBS. So we've actually raised the costs and raised the regulation and bureaucracy on the smaller institutions. In some ways, that's one of the unintended consequences of what we've had. We do adopt a proportionate approach. We try and be less intrusive on smaller institutions and more intrusive on the bigger institutions. But I think up until we have an effective functioning deposit insurance that caters for the welfare of the poorest, we will have to be pretty intrusive. Hopefully Parliament will pass that in the next year or two, and it might prompt a slightly different response. Thanks, Chair.
Quickly, just to say that the amount you require to apply for a license is spelled out there. It's actually a fraction of what you actually need for the bank. And I'm not sure that it is quite a barrier to entry. The amount of money, that of capital that you're going to have to deploy to get the bank going, far exceeds what is required initially by a multiple. And let's not also forget that as the bank then gets licensed, it is the business it engages in and how risky it is that will end up determining whether the regulator asks for more capital. The riskier the business lines they engage in, the more regulatory capital would be imposed on them. And I actually philosophically struggle because, you see, the underlying approach of prudential regulator is to protect the users of the financial system. So why is it necessary to protect the depositors? Because the conversation we have been having today has been about borrowers. Let savers lose confidence in the financial system and take for the hills. There is nothing for the borrowers to borrow. And that is why the underlying philosophy is to then protect the depositors. And it is a very important thing because they are normally the ones who suffer when a bank fails. The borrowers will not suffer because a bank has failed. If anything, they might say, thanks, maybe I don't even have to pay. The bank is gone. Who do I pay to? But the depositors are left hanging. They are the ones that would have to worry. So as we consider these things and we move forward, we must not lose sight of the fact that we have got to constantly balance that these customers of these institutions, they are the savers who are actually funding, and they are the borrowers who actually are accessing what the savers had provided. And it is constantly striking that balance, cognizant of the fact that FISRA has put out this financial regulatory objective without ordering them, which means that it's a constant balance. You've got to be looking at prudential regulation, you must look at competition, you must look at financial inflation, you must look at all of those and constantly balance and make sure that you do not have a sector that actually disappears in front of you.
Yeah. And Mimos, do you want to have the last bite? Mabileza, Marulov. Oh, you want to go? Okay. Mabileza and then Mushuvamo.
Mine is just that I have some ignorance on this one.
Okay.
I'm just assuming on page 54, the last slide, the collective investment schemes, is your typical Mokodusano. and the friendly societies, it's us with our uniform and beret, the friendly societies. I'm just assuming, perhaps.
Okay. Collective investment are unit trust.
Unit
the
trust.
Friendly societies will
okay.
Be here.
You are covering Renaba Mekhodisano and then the societies where every month we meet and collect money.
At the moment we don't cover it.
But it's this one, friendly societies.
It's difficult when we have a dialogue.
Okay.
Remember, because when you fight, then I can't intervene. It's okay when you still talk. Nicely, but when there's a fight, then you know there's a chain. Okay, are you true, honourable member? Can you finish up your question? Are you true? Putting it true.
Yeah, I'm just saying, I'm assuming.
But I've got an answer.
No. Okay. Honourable Shivamo?
No, so your notion, Governor, borders on being reactionary because and problematic completely that all we must just care about is the depositors and we must not care about the transformation of the banking space. It's problematic because so in the process of protecting depositors we have a historical obligation to change the ownership and control of the financial services sector as a whole. So and the fact of the matter is that the amounts that are required for people to gain access into that space are prohibitive for majority of the population. So you should think maybe what Kuben is saying to say that let's look into different ranks of what other categories of banks can be considered as part of the future in terms of and then we then ourselves as the legislators here check if we can amend the Banks Act to say that let us have these following categories so that we do not completely cut off those that are supposed to benefit from the so-called freedom from participating in real economic ownership. Because it's 25 years now, there is no fundamental changes in terms of ownership and control of the financial services sector. It will be 50 years, the situation will still be the same. If that the logic is that, no, the black people must just be consumers, let's just protect them. And we do not want to deal much with the issues of ownership and control. We must not shy away from that fundamental principle because that is what we're obligated to do. Even the Constitution says that Section 9.2 of the Constitution obliges us to pass legislation that should address the economic imbalances of the past. So we have to engage in that dialogue. And that does not mean that it is going to be done in a way that is going to be reckless and it will just make the entire system vulnerable to wrongdoing. The regulatory mechanisms that exist must be strong. There must be clarity in terms of what happens. There must be, of course, enough money for those who want to do it, but it must not be prohibitive. But the way it is now is very prohibitive, both insurance and the banking sector. And then the Reserve Bank and the prudential authorities as institutions that are responsible for this should begin to think of what do we do to then deal with the demographical representative ownership and control model of the financial services sector.
Okay, Governor, I think the question that I have is partly covered here by the input of the members. But I just wanted to check, in the light of the presentation or the responses that was just had, what then could be done just to demonopolize the five large banks? You know, what could be the advice that can be given? Now, the market concentration, is it good for the consumer? I hear your issue also on the depositor, and I'm sympathetic in the sense that I thought you were saying the thing for both, not only for one. Yeah, thanks.
Exactly, Chair. That was my point. So I didn't understand what was reactionary about saying that. Because we're talking as if there are no black depositors. There are black depositors who must also be protected. But I do not want to enter into a dialogue about this. There was once a proposal for the Dedicated Banks Act. And the Dedicated Banks Act was meant to deal with the kinds of things that the deputy governor was raising, to say that there might be banks that we allow to come into the scheme that are either niche players and so forth, and they might require different capital. It's a discussion that we had had. The thing about deconcentrating the banks, Chair, is a huge subject on its own. And I'd like to, how did we end up here? How did we end up with a concentrated banking sector? And I'd like take it back to 1918 when we experienced our first banking crisis. Throughout, every time we experienced a banking crisis, the weak banks either consolidated or a weak bank got taken over by another. And as that process evolved over the years, you ended up with the concentration. By the way, the name ABSA stands for Amalgamated Bank of South Africa. It ended up being about five banks coming together, because some of them were weak and there were some that were strong, but if they came together, they could make this thing. It is a big public policy issue globally. South Africa, Australia and New Zealand preferred what was called a four-pillar approach of a banking system, as that consolidation was taking place, to say that you have got this institution, focus on them and have the other players come in. Except that New Zealand's four pillars are actually Australian banks rather than New Zealand banks. Switzerland is now ending up with a two-pillar model, just left with two banks because the others have disappeared from the crisis. Every banking crisis leads to that concentration. But what distinguishes Switzerland from is that is a country with a banking culture. So there are all sorts of banks that are regional, others just focusing on these clients, or focusing on foreign clients, or just focusing on small businesses, or I will only do the top 10 businesses in Switzerland. So you have got all of those things, and you would have the concentration that takes place. It's a big issue because in the U.S. too, and in the aftermath of the banking crisis, they ended up with fewer banks than more. So it's a conversation that we must have. It's an absolutely valid conversation, and even from a prudential perspective, globally we have been working with what we had called ending the too big to fail. And that says that if you have got the concentrations, it could happen that certain institutions grow to the point where they feel that even if they fail, government will have to come in, because what will they do? If I go, these services are gone. And it becomes a big issue. We're trying on a global perspective to come with this. And there are various regulatory tools that people end up coming with, others being to slap them with additional capital. And honestly, our banks ended up with higher capital adequacy because sometimes we had to take cognizance of the fact that it is a concentrated banking sector. But it is a global conversation that is actually taking place at the moment. Yes, collective investment schemes is what used to be called unit trusts. So it's, I know collective, it sounds like it is it's not quite stock sales. And friendly societies, it's almost there. Your stock sales, burial societies, those kinds of things. Although there is always some of them evolve and they become what is cooperative financial institutions. If they take that step, then they get regulated differently. But very clearly, in the next regulatory strategy, we need to put some framework that is friendly to friendly societies.
Just 30 seconds. The National Treasury is commissioning some research on why cooperative financial institutions don't graduate into cooperative banks and why cooperative banks don't graduate. They're also doing similar research on why Stockwells don't graduate into cooperative financial institutions. In fact, the minimum amount of deposits for a CFI is 2 million rand. There are some Stockwells in South Africa with 50 million rand of deposits, but they have not applied for a CFI license. So maybe our rules are too onerous. Maybe they don't want to be supervised by the SARB. We would like to think that being registered has certain benefits. So the Treasury is commissioning research to try and improve the graduation rate in this sector.
Thank you very much. That brings us to the last item on the agenda, which is a vote of thanks, I think. Honourable members, I just want to thank you so much for coming in and making first the quorum, because it's not always about being able to raise matters, because some matters are raised by other members and we do not have to repeat them. Thank you so much for coming, honorable members. And to SARB, I just want to thank the leader of the team, and I congratulate you on your appointment of a woman in your leadership structure. I remember you did say that during our visit in the Gauteng province, that Ms. Chabana is engaged in the leadership structure of SARB. We want to appreciate that, and we're looking forward to seeing her face in the next financial year report. We thank you so much for coming in. The conversations themselves, in their nature, are continuous. And we do not have an ambition to finish all the conversations in one sitting. We appreciate the fact that you even made much more easier for us that the two presentations are together. We are now adjourning, and the fact that you are here today does not mean that it is the end of our interaction for this particular discussion. When we need any additional information, we will, through the committee secretary, keep in touch. We want to thank the staff of the committee as well, and the meeting stands adjourned. Thank you.